Hi, I'm Henry Baer.
And I'm Tyler Johnson.
And you're listening to The Doctor's Art, a podcast that explores meaning in medicine. Throughout our medical training and career, we have pondered, what makes medicine meaningful? Can a stronger understanding of this meaning create better doctors? How can we build healthcare institutions that nurture the doctor-patient connection? What can we learn about the human condition from accompanying our patients in times of suffering?
In seeking answers to these questions, we meet with deep thinkers working across healthcare, from doctors and nurses to patients and healthcare executives, those who have collected a career's worth of hard-earned wisdom. Probing the moral heart that beats at the core of medicine, we will hear stories that are by turns heartbreaking, amusing, inspiring, challenging, and enlightening. We welcome anyone curious about why doctors do what they do. Join us as we think out loud about what illness and healing can teach us about some of life's biggest questions.
When Dr. Jesse Ehrenfeld attended his first meeting at the American Medical Association as a first-year medical student, he was struck by the collaborative spirit he witnessed among physicians of all specialties from across the United States. But he was also overcome with insecurity over whether he, as a gay man, would ever be truly accepted for who he was. 22 years later, Dr. Ehrenfeld is now the first openly gay president of the American Medical Association, or the AMA. An anesthesiologist by training, he is also a senior associate dean and tenured professor at the Medical College of Wisconsin. In this episode, Dr. Ehrenfeld shares his journey in medicine, from how he has channeled his experiences with discrimination to becoming a leading advocate of health equity, especially for LGBTQ individuals, to his time as a combat veteran in the Navy, to now leading one of the most influential medical organizations in America. Our conversation also ranges in topic from the future of medical education to physician burnout to the promises of digital health and more. Jesse, thank you so much for taking the time to join us and welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Really happy to talk with you all.
So we're going to hear a lot about your work at the AMA, but before we get there, I'd like to hear more about your personal journey. What initially drew you to medicine?
I grew up in Wilmington, Delaware. Both my parents are in healthcare. My mom's a psychologist. My dad's a dentist. But I knew that while I was really interested in the healing arts, psychology and dentistry were not for me. So when I was in high school and in college, I knew pretty early that I wanted to become a physician. And so was fortunate to get into the University of Chicago for medical school and then was in Boston at Mass General for residency, fellowship, faculty for a bit, which was sort of the start of my career as a physician scientist, doing health equity work, doing informatics work, and ultimately healthcare policy, which brought me to the AMA.
So you are trained as an anesthesiologist, right? So what drew you to that particular specialty?
You know, it was the only thing in my third year of medical school that I really liked. And I remember still not wanting to go home at the end of the day on my little 2-week mini rotation. And I said, you know what, I'm just going to go with it. There's a lot that I like about different parts of medicine, but I like being in the operating room. I like being in acute care environment. I love the fact that when I, you know, see a blood pressure that's too high, I can reach in a drawer, pull out a medication, administer the drug, and the number changes. And there's something that is very gratifying about that. I knew I didn't want to be a surgeon. I was not good at anatomy. I liked being in the operating room. There's this myth that anesthesiologists don't talk to their patients, and it's far from true. I think one of the most challenging parts of my job is in the pre-op holding area where I'm meeting with patients, you know, trying to put them at ease, get the information that you need while all sort of adhering to a schedule. And those moments matter, you know, when you put your hand on someone's shoulder, when you hear about their anxiety about going under and you alleviate that. It's a privilege, right, to be a physician and to be in those intimate moments. And for me, anesthesia just sort of fit the bill.
Yeah, I know the first time I went in and shadowed an anesthesiologist in medical school, I just remember thinking like, wow, this is like the ultimate version of being a puppeteer. Like you pull up here a little bit and like the blood pressure goes up and then you do this thing and it goes down. It requires such an elegant and real-time understanding of human physiology to be able to react to things in real time like that. I think there really is, as you say, an elegance to it that you just don't get at least that immediately in almost any other branch of medicine.
you definitely have to be able to think on your feet. And not all specialties are like that, but certainly those who work in sort of acute settings, it's an important component.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about, you mentioned very briefly that as you were sort of growing into your career as a faculty member, that health equity started to form a prominent part of what you were thinking about and what you were doing. Tell us a little bit about that plank of your work, sort of where did that come from and how did that evolve?
Well, health equity has always been deeply important and deeply personal to me as a gay man. And I certainly have had the good, the bad, and the ugly experiences accessing healthcare, receiving healthcare, being discriminated against, being embraced because of my sexual orientation. And so understanding early that I wanted to make healthcare better for LGBTQ people was really important and certainly was a part of my work early in medical school, was a foundational part of my work in residency. And as a junior faculty member, I was fortunate to be given the leeway and the support to co-found the nation's second academic LGBTQ health program. That was at Vanderbilt University Medical Center. It's still there, doing very well, because I know that there are, unfortunately, still too many gaps between the care that people should be getting and the care that is often delivered, particularly for marginalized populations.
You know, one of the things that I, in listening to your inaugural address when you were inaugurated as the president of the AMA, to some degree, the theme of equity is a thread that's woven throughout your address, but there's one part of the address where you focus on that more specifically. And one of the things that you touch on in that part of the address is talking both about maternal mortality and also infant mortality, right? And infant mortality to me always hits at an especially raw place for multiple reasons, right? On the one hand, obviously, because you're talking about a newborn baby, right? The most helpless, defenseless being that there is, but also because it strikes so close to the core of just how deep-seated of a problem this is, right? Like there are so many times when I think that initially there was a sort of a reaction against health equity work, oftentimes people would say, well, but what about the life choices and what about this and what about that, right? And all these things. But here you have a person who literally has not even made a choice yet, right? And yet the difference in mortality, which I don't remember the exact statistic that you cite, you were talking, I think, about some particular city. But in any case, the point is that I think you were talking about the gap between infant mortality for Black babies and white babies was strikingly high. And I guess the other thing that really struck me about your AMA inaugural address is that you have this, what seems to me to be this kind of urgent moral impetus behind what is really impelling your leadership, much of which I think is directed at moving the AMA towards a place where there is more of an overt focus on equity and where the AMA helps the medical community in the United States to reach more of those goals. But can you talk a little bit more about the moral passion that you feel as the president of the AMA and sort of what that looks like in your leadership?
Well, certainly the AMA has had a long-standing effort to eliminate these health inequities, improve health outcomes for populations that have been ignored, cast aside, de-invested in. But that means that our colleagues, the physician workforce, has to understand what's happening. We need the tools and the resources to confront these health inequities, to advance equity across all aspects of the healthcare system. And unfortunately, the driver of so many of these challenges really is structural racism. It's structural racism in healthcare and in our healthcare system. There is no biological reason that a Black baby in Milwaukee has an order of magnitude greater risk of dying within their first year of life than a white baby. That's not biology. That's structural racism. It's inaccess to care. It's challenges around stable housing. It's challenges accessing resources that lead to these horrifically challenging outcomes. So the AMA has not shied away from this. We created a Center for Health Equity in 2019, launched a strategic plan 2 years later that really calls on all physicians to contribute to this collective work to dismantle the structural and the social drivers of these challenges. And, you know, we're making progress, but we live in a time where these issues are not easy. They're not easy to talk about. They're not easy to resource. but it's some of the most important work that the AMA is doing. A big component of this is making sure that we have diverse healthcare teams. And from an equity lens, we know that diverse healthcare teams lead to better patient outcomes for diverse patients. So if we want to improve the outcomes of our patients, we need diverse healthcare teams. We got a bit of a blow this summer with the Supreme Court decision on race in higher education, which effectively eliminated affirmative action programs across higher education. And that certainly includes healthcare and medical schools. But I'm optimistic. You know, we have seen some small incremental gains in terms of the number of underrepresented students coming into medical school. Certainly there's tremendous demand. We just need to make sure that we're equipped to support those students, those teams for the greater good of the nation.
So since early in your career, drawing from your own experiences, these issues of equity have compelled you to not simply accept things for the way they are, but to create initiatives and lead changes to bring about a better future. Has this inclination towards policy and leadership always been there? How did you cultivate this interest, and how did that lead you eventually to the AMA?
I've always sort of had this worldview that, you know, there are a lot of people in the world who are happy to complain about how bad things are, how irritating our politicians can be, how annoyed they are about a particular, you know, policy that's impacting, you know, what they and their family can or can't do. And then there's a small subset of people in the world who raise their hand and say, I'm not just annoyed about it, I'm going to do something about it. And I always felt like it wasn't fair to just complain about the things that you don't like if you're not willing to step forward and try to make a difference. And so with that mindset, I remember walking into my first AMA meeting I talked about in my inauguration speech, you know, in 2001, and seeing the House of Medicine and seeing that this is where policy can be changed, where advocacy for the profession starts.
For our listeners who are not familiar, can you talk a little bit about what is the House of Delegates? How does that work? What is the function within the AMA?
Yeah, great. Thanks for raising that. So the AMA has more than 190 states and specialties that twice a year come together. And this is really special. And it's actually foundational because it really is where the AMA draws its power from. When I speak on TV or at the White House or advocate for a particular policy position, I'm not speaking for Jesse Ehrenfeld. I'm speaking for the democratically decided policies of the AMA that come from our House of Delegates, which is that group of duly appointed 190 states and specialties coming together twice a year to set policy. It's really something because what happens is you have people from all over the country coming together, 600 plus delegates, an equal number of alternates, to debate policy, to argue, to bring their evidence, to talk about their experiences in open forum. People hear all of that, they make their decisions, and then they vote. And in spite of some really contentious, hard issues, right, you know, around everything that we need to deal with in medicine, the amazing thing is that at the end of the day, people then go out and have dinner together. And I wish that happened in Congress. It used to, because we recognize that at the end of the day, this is about the profession and our patients. And so we can have these hard policy debates, make a decision, and then move on. And that is really what the House of Delegates process is. And when I speak for the AMA and speak for physicians, we cover basically 98% of physicians practicing in the U.S. because of that broad reach of those 190 states and specialties, which have such a far-reaching membership.
So can I ask a sort of a, I don't know, I guess for lack of a better word, it's kind of a philosophy of leadership question that gets to your relationship with the House of Delegates and the wider membership of the AMA. One of the things that strikes me is that, as I mentioned, when I listen to your inaugural address, the thing that stands out to me the most, you know, there are lots of different kinds of leaders, and some leaders are kind of technocrats, which is great, and some are kind of organizational wizards, which are great. But your speech struck me more in the vein of like a Barack Obama, a sort of this hope and change kind of a theme rather than kind of technocracy or whatever. And I have to imagine that with that being the case, there may be times when you feel torn between representing what you understand to be, as you put it, the democratically arrived at consensus of the membership versus maybe taking a step beyond that and trying to sort of impel the membership towards what you feel to be the morally right thing to do or, you know, whatever. How do you as a leader strike that balance, trying to stay true to your own moral compass while also representing this incredibly disparate group of people who all have their own backgrounds and their own beliefs and are coming together in this very messy way to try to make a consensus for what the organization is going to institutionally represent?
Well, you know, it's a great question. And the good news is that there's not always perfect alignment, but there's really good alignment. And my mission as AMA president, as it is for all presidents, right, is to carry out our mission of promoting the art and science of medicine, the betterment of public health, and to advocate for those policies. And, you know, my main priority this year really is trying to help advance our recovery plan for America's physicians, which is kind of our overarching advocacy roadmap for addressing some of the key drivers of burnout and the pain points that physicians experience. And we may have differences around what a reformed Medicare payment system ought to be, but I think you'd be hard-pressed to find many physicians in the U.S. who believe that the Medicare payment system, as it's constructed today, is sustainable and works.
You don't have people marching on your office saying, leave it alone.
Leave it alone. No, it hasn't happened yet. I have not found a colleague who thinks that, you know, spending hours on the phone back and forth with insurance companies to get something authorized that their patient needs helps anybody. I still remember this little jump for joy during COVID. It was one of those few moments when my hospital and health system went to crisis documentation standards and they stripped out all of the junk that we didn't no longer suddenly need to document so we could focus on taking care of patients. And now it's all back. I don't know anybody who wants that stuff back, right? You know, we torture people with these deaths by a thousand paper cuts with, you know, click a box here, check a box there, but they don't really help us actually improve the care of our patients. So again, when you look at sort of the broad themes of what we're doing, again, there may be differences that are more tactical around, you know, what a particular objective can be, but that's the work of the House of Delegates to try to help shape some of those things. And obviously my work as AMA president to drive it forward.
The work of the AMA, I mean, you're representing almost all physicians, or at least the interests of physicians in this country. And a lot of the issues are systemic. A lot of the changes you're advocating for, like, they have to unfurl over a pretty long time frame just because there's so many moving parts to it. You're president for a year. And I guess I'm just thinking about what would success in that year look like? What did you want to do as you stepped into this role? And by the end of it, as you look back, what would it mean to you to have done the ideal job in this role for that year?
Yeah, it's a great question. So two thoughts come to mind. One is all of the activities of the AMA are really organized around three buckets, making sure that we can remove the things that get in the way of us doing our jobs, right? All those obstacles that get in the way of patient care, making sure that we have training programs, lifelong learning, medical education that's innovative and actually meets the needs of our trainees today and tomorrow, and then trying to confront disease and the burden of chronic disease and public health crises, things like COVID. And so all of the activities get rolled up under those three priorities. Those priorities don't change year to year, right? We don't throw them out when the next president comes in June and start fresh. They're enduring. Obviously, tactically, we pivot based on what the policy environment is. So for me, it comes down to, you know, am I able to make a meaningful contribution? And am I able to, in some way, leave the profession better than it was? And I think the answer is going to be yes to that. We are seeing some real success in terms of insurance companies finally feeling the pressure on prior authorization and voluntarily removing swaths of procedures that no longer do you have to get approval before you can deliver those services to patients. We're seeing the administration say, you know, we don't have the workforce that we need. And maybe it is time to think about how we expand GME meaningfully through the Medicare program by expanding spots and changing the J-1 visa program and those kinds of things. So I expect that there will be some very specific policy victories that, you know, I'll be able to articulate as having happened under my watch. But I have no doubt that through all of our work, all of our ability to support physicians across the nation, that we're having an impact every day in ways that are not always as obvious as a law gets signed or an administrative rule goes through.
I want to tell you briefly about a book that I read a number of years ago as a way of asking what I think is a really important question for a lot of the things that the AMA is considering, many of which you've already touched on. So there was this book written by a guy named Paul Tough called Whatever It Takes, which is about this guy named Jeffrey Kennedy, who is an educator who worked in New York City. And in effect, he began his career, this teacher began his career looking at people, children who were coming up into elementary school in these particular neighborhoods in New York that were very under-resourced and very underprivileged. And probably not surprisingly, they were not doing very well in school, right? And so at first, I'm greatly oversimplifying the story, but in effect, it was like, oh, well, maybe what we need to do is make these certain modifications in the classroom, right? And so then they would make these modifications in the classroom and maybe make marginal gains, but it really wouldn't make that much of a difference in the big picture, right? So then it was like, well, maybe what we need are modifications in the classroom and also an after-school program, right? So then they would try that and that would make a little bit more of a gain, but it still wasn't enough. So then it was like, well, maybe what we need to do is modifications in the classroom and an after-school program, and we need to start in the years before the person even gets to school to try to make changes, you know, implement a free preschool program or whatever. So then they would try that. The point is just to say that what ended up happening is that these inequities were so pervasive. You mentioned systemic racism before. It got to a point where the potential scope of the programs that needed to be involved to really try to get at the root of what was happening became almost infinitely large, right? Because they were things, to the point about infant mortality, things that started literally the day that a person was born, right? Like there's a lot of data, for example, now about how the zip code where you are born is determinative in terms of how long you'll live and how much money you'll make and whatever when you're an adult, right? So the reason that I bring that book up is because one of the things that strikes me is that as you are the president of the AMA and you're trying to affect whether it's equity or admissions to medical school or like whatever the sort of the tip of the spear is, in almost every case, I mean, maybe it's different if you're talking about prior authorization, right? Like that's a change that you could actually, if you could convince the insurance programs, maybe you could actually just make the change. But so many of the bigger picture, and I would say morally weighty changes, are just the tip of this very broad, very expansive, you know, sort of, as you put it, systemic problem. So I guess all of that is to say that as a person who clearly feels very strongly about these things and wants to really advance this work and make these changes, how do you think about where to guide the AMA to invest its resources when the problems are so broad in scope and really require, in many cases, going back sort of years before the person even arrives in a doctor's office or in a medical school or whatever, to try to really get at the root of what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, the answer is we have to work on all fronts, and we have to do the small things that we know lead to poor patient outcomes today in a clinic setting because people aren't culturally competent in a particular area or delivering care in a way that is inclusive. But we also need to push upstream to address those drivers. And a very pragmatic example of the way that the AMA is leading on that is in our hometown of Chicago, where the AMA is headquartered through the West Side United Partnership. This is a place where the AMA has committed millions of dollars to the West Side United Collaborative. It's a partnership. It's got residents who live in the community, healthcare professionals, civic and business leaders, a bunch of faith-based organizations, community groups, to try to dismantle structural inequities. That program provides low interest or interest-free loans to entrepreneurs to start businesses. It's providing capital to refurbish housing stock, to remove lead from homes, to make homes safer, to make homes habitable. They're doing job training education programs just to try to lift up the economic microenvironment for this community that, because of redlining and other old disinvestment for decades, has led to some of the worst health outcomes in the city of Chicago. People have a life expectancy of 10 years lower than folks who live on Michigan Avenue. And so it's a really, I think, exciting opportunity for the AMA to think about how can we create these innovative efforts to deploy capital and resources and share power upstream in ways that are scalable. And this is not the only, you know, partnership of its kind. There are several like it around the country. There's the one outside of Atlanta. There's some on the West Coast. There's some things happening in New York. I'm hopeful that it will be very successful in Chicago and can scale to other communities. In my day job in Wisconsin, leading the largest health philanthropy in the state, we're looking at launching a similar program in Milwaukee. So I think, again, to get to your question, we can't just say it's too hard. We can't be overwhelmed by the enormity of the task. We have to dig in. We have to do what we can in the places where we have immediate command and control, which is often our clinics and our health systems. And then we have to take a broadened lens to make sure that we move upstream.
So we've talked a lot about issues of equity, but one of the priorities of the AMA, as you've shared with us, you touched on very briefly, is this issue of physician burnout, which is something that we come back to again and again on this show in particular. And I'd love to hear from your vantage point, what's the problem? I mean, not in terms of like the number of physician burnout, yeah, but like, what are some of the main drivers of it from what you're seeing, from hearing all these stories from physician leaders across the whole country? What's causing it? And in your view, what needs to be changed to actually address the roots of it?
Yeah, so I'll skip the statistics. I'll just point out that, you know, in our data, 2/3 of physicians at the peak of COVID said that they were experiencing burnout. So it is a huge problem. People leaving practice, reducing their hours, turning to other professions. You know, the drivers of this are multifactorial, but the challenge really is around how difficult we're making it for people to practice medicine. The inefficiencies in practices, right? The phone calls to the insurance companies, the prior authorization calls. I was driving across the state to La Crosse a few months back with a physician colleague. We're in the car and he's driving and, you know, he's got like one of those little video displays on his car, and it comes up because his phone's ringing and it says, you know, the name of insurance company. And he goes, "Oh, Jesse, I'm so sorry. I have to take this call. I've been trying to get this thing approved for this patient and it's been back and forth." And it's like, sure, you can take the call. So I'm just sitting there listening, and he's on the phone with this third party payer, and he's like, "Listen, I'm so sorry. I'm driving. You know, it's been really hard to get a hold of you guys. I'm not at my computer. So, you know, if you need like the lab value on a certain date, you know, it's like one with urosepsis who needs approval for admission to the hospital." It's crazy. He's like, I can pull over and get it for you, but please don't make me call you back. And you hear the frustration in his voice as he's pleading with this nameless person on the other end of the line to get his patient something that she obviously needs. And we do those things. You know, we have these federal quality reporting systems that are check the box episodes, and I get my, you know, reports back. They're a year stale and they do nothing to help me understand how I can actually improve my practice in the operating room. And yet we tie incentive payments to that. We have a huge, you know, fleet of people who do nothing but manage the reporting systems, which is expensive. And all of these things, again, just take us away from time with our patients. So we know that there are so many drivers of why people are frustrated, why they are burnt out. And unfortunately, when people are burnt out, they are reluctant to get the help that they need, which is a separate but related issue that we also need to address. And so the AMA is trying to work hard to make sure that we provide resources for practices to think about how do they re-engineer their workflows? How do they make it easier for people to focus on the things that matter? But we need regulatory relief. We need legislative solutions to solve some of these challenges, or else we're going to still be where we are today.
So I want to ask a question to follow up on that and then maybe transition a little bit to talking about medical education, which I think is really, really key to a lot of the things that we're talking about. But so to be clear, we would absolutely 110% agree that there are many systematic and regulatory factors that are inhibiting doctors' ability to just practice medicine in the way that they feel is best for their patients, right? And certainly eliminating those would be helpful. I think, though, too, that Henry and I have both been struck repeatedly in having these conversations that we have on the podcast, which we've now, you know, we're probably going somewhere close to 100 hours of these conversations now, that there is also a much more ineffable, difficult to pin down factor that is at play that I think is one of the major factors at play, which is just a sense that we have lost, as a medical community, we have lost a sense of shared meaning that once bound us together, right? And that I think many people, even aside from the regulatory and systematic barriers, it just feels purposeless sometimes. It just feels like that moral drive that got us there in the first place, and that for most people, you know, impelled them through anatomy exams and late night studying biochemistry and 30-hour shifts on the wards and all the rest of it. It's like it just somewhere along the line just kind of evaporated. And so I guess that as the president of the AMA and a person who, you know, is as connected to the network of physicians in the US as anybody else. What is your read on that? And to the degree that you think that's true, what, if anything, do you think we can do to try to help return that sense of shared meaning?
You know, it's really an interesting question. And I would give you the context that I see the world through, which is, you know, for a moment in 2020, doctors were cheered, right? I remember the sign outside of my hospital, the chalk art that, you know, local school kids came and did one day to thank us for what we were doing, right? To try to help keep our community safe and get through the earliest days of the pandemics. And then we started getting attacked. And the misinformation problem that has exploded and is not going away, the relentless attacks on science, the loss of trust in the profession, I think are the background for the phenomena that you describe. And I will tell you, you know, I got to serve in the Navy for 10 years as a reservist and was overseas a bit. And there was nothing more special than the small team of highly trained, well-coordinated physicians that I got to work with on the front lines in battle who were so mission-focused, right? And the performance of that team was extraordinary. You know, 98% of people who came to our forward operating abuse trauma hospital survived, right? If you got to us, we would keep you alive because we were a very well-oiled machine where I could anticipate every move of the trauma surgeon and the radiologist and the emergency doc. We all knew exactly what was happening. We lose that when people live in an environment where they feel like that purpose is no longer as elevated, centered, central to what we do. And I think, you know, the practice environment has become much more difficult for physicians. We still have an abundance of people who want to go to medical school. Applications are up. That is incredible. But something's happening as people are going through training and having these experiences that is deeply concerning. And that's part of why the AMA is so focused on understanding how do we restore the joy into the practice of medicine. We actually have a program that's basically titled that, the Joy in Medicine Recognition Program, which is all about how do we ensure that practices and groups and health systems have a roadmap to restore that joy, that pride, whatever you want to call it, in the profession so that people are re-energized and centered back on what we came into medicine to begin with.
Yeah, I have to say, when I was listening to your inaugural address and you used the term joy in medicine, literally my first thought was, I don't know that I have ever heard anyone use that term before. I mean, it's almost just as a point of comparison on Twitter over the last few days, there's this sort of, a medical meme that's floating around that is about the percent of people who are in medical school. And I, you know, who knows how reliable the statistic is, but the point is, regardless, the percent of people who are in medical school who do not plan on practicing medicine in the traditional way. Like they already know that they want to do something that is purely non-patient facing, which, not that there's anything wrong with going into the business of medicine or policy reform or anything else, but it is nonetheless striking if, you know, and the number that is there is, I've seen various versions of this, but 40, 50, 60%. The idea that there would be anywhere close to half of people in medical school who already know that they don't want to take care of patients in any direct way, that seems, you know, pretty striking and very much at odds with the idea that medicine would be a joyful profession, which, so that then gets me to a question that I really am genuinely interested to hear your thoughts about. In your inaugural address, you have this very interesting small section where you shift and put yourself into the position of the patient. And you say, when I'm a patient and I get sick, I deserve to have a doctor who cares about me as a person and who actually cares what happens to me and actually knows me well enough to have me matter and my welfare matter, right? At the same time, you have also mentioned earlier in the podcast and in other places as well, that we are just at the dawning of this transformational era in medicine where we're going to have the incorporation of AI. And there's a lot of discussion about for which parts of our job are humans going to become superfluous in effect. So all of that is to say that as you have, on the one hand, AI advancing into medicine in whatever way that's going to look. On the other hand, you already have these statistics about burnout and people not even who are in medical school, not even wanting to take care of patients. And yet you're talking about trying to restore a sense of joy in medicine. What has to happen in medical education to fix what in many ways feels like a looming crisis of doctors who don't even like what they do, many of whom apparently don't even want to do what they, you know, ostensibly initially signed up to do, and many of whom are not exactly threatening, but who are saying, we just may not do this anymore. We, you know, we may be out. What fundamental reform needs to happen to medical education to try to square that circle?
Well, we've got to reimagine how we train our students to work and be successful in the environment in which they're actually going to practice. And that's a big lift, right? When I think about in 2000, when I started medical school 23 years ago, wow, you know, what my coursework, what my faculty, what my rotations were preparing me to do, and then what I actually have to do today, there's an obvious disconnect. And I think, you know, the medical education community has recognized that. In fact, the entire field of health system science, which is, you know, dedicated to how do you make sure that you understand the delivery system so that you can work in it and work in it effectively, is new. That didn't exist 23 years ago. I think there's that important pivot going on. But when you talk about technology and AI and the humanity of the practice of the profession, I actually think that there was a widely reported study in, I think, one of the JAMA Open journals recently that encapsulates this really well for me. And it was basically, the headline was, you know, AI is more compassionate, more empathetic than humans, right? And it was based on this study that, you know, patients rated, you know, some experience or something. I don't exactly how they did it, but
I think it was chatting with a provider, like through a text chat.
Something. Yeah. The takeaway there isn't that actually AI and computers and algorithms are empathetic. The takeaway is that we're burnt out. And, you know, when I walked into the pre-op holding area and was consenting a patient for cardiac surgery, and the patient told me that they didn't want a blood transfusion, even if their life depended on it, because they haven't been vaccinated for COVID and they don't want to accidentally get vaccinated because they got a blood transfusion from somebody who had been vaccinated, you know, that is just exhausting. And, you know, you have this moment where you say, okay, do I sit down and have a 20-minute conversation, which may not be productive, with this patient, or do I move on with life? And unfortunately, we practice an environment where more and more physicians are just moving on, and they've lost that capacity to bring forward what is a foundational component of the practice of medicine, which is that humanity. But what I do believe is possible is the reason that the AI is so good is it never tires, right? It never gets tired of having the same conversation over and over and over about why it is crazy to not get vaccinated, why it is crazy to not want a blood transfusion because you are worried about getting COVID vaccine from it. So there's a way to leverage the technology to relieve the burden, to detether us from our computers so that we can get back to the things that really matter. And that's where I think we're going to land. But that's an important skill set that has to be taught. And I think schools are grappling. I mean, I think everybody's grappling with ChatGPT and large language models and all of these algorithms, what they mean. But I think that's going to be a critical, critical place where medical education is going to have to pivot to figure out how do we make sure that our trainees are prepared for the adoption and the use of those technologies in effective ways.
So it sounds like you're actually, I wouldn't go as far as to say that you're necessarily optimistic, but at least you feel it is necessary for trainees to, whether they want to or whether they like to or not, they have to be aware and familiar in how to use these tools effectively.
I am optimistic. I think there's a lot of hype out there. I think we're going to see some colossal failures of tools, and it's going to be a bumpy ride. I will be very honest about that in terms of my predicting and looking in the crystal ball. But, you know, I don't think AI will replace physicians, but I think physicians who use AI will replace those who don't.
That's a soundbite. We can put that on a bumper sticker.
No, I mean, I absolutely see it. I mean, I, as an intern right now, you know, we are perhaps more so than at any other stage of medical training, it might be true that we deal with more paperwork, we deal with a lot of documentation just day to day, like things that don't feel like they directly contribute to making a patient feel better. I do happen to use a lot of GPT already, just for a lot of that work. It does help. It does alleviate. It shaves off. I mean, you're so busy in residency. If you can shave off 5 minutes from like a discharge, it actually surprisingly does more than you would think 5 minutes back can do for you. So I absolutely see where you're coming from. going back to a little bit about directly with your work at the AMA, I've spoken with people who are interested in health policy, and they are intellectually interested in the issues. And they, in an ideal world, they would like to be more involved. But for lots of people I know, they don't want to get in, they don't want to wade in because of the politics of the thing. You're dealing with, you mentioned earlier that part of your work is having to go to Congress, for example. And I know lots of people who are interested in policies, but are turned off by the politics of it. How do you conceptualize your, I don't know what the word is, relationship with politics? Is that something that you enjoy doing? Is that something you feel like you have to put up with, or something else entirely?
Well, I think people have different perspectives on, you know, how much they want to and how much they enjoy engaging with politicians and policy. I mean, we live in a divided nation right now, more divided than certainly any point in the past several decades. The good news is that, you know, the people who join the profession put their patients first. And so that allows for alignment even when we have different perspectives. I will say, I don't know who came up with this quote, but it's often cited that, you know, if you don't have a seat at the table, you're on the menu. And that is very true in politics, right? If there is nobody advocating for physicians, the profession, or patients, well, I'll tell you, the insurance companies are there and our healthcare systems are there. There's got to be somebody who's stepping up for doctors. And that's the primary role of the AMA. And some people get really excited about going to Washington and meeting with their congressperson, their senator, you know, their state representative. There are others where, you know, that is the last thing on earth that they would ever sign up to do. But that's okay. You can still contribute in meaningful ways, right? You can get engaged simply by writing a check for your AMA membership. You can get engaged by you know, participating in your state or county medical society, your specialty society. All of those things, right, are advocacy and engagement. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're leading the march on Washington, but we certainly absolutely need individuals and people and doctors who can lift up our voice. And without that, the profession will suffer.
So let me ask a sort of a, I don't know, strategic question, I guess, for you as the president of the AMA. You know, there have been multiple points during conversations that we've had on the podcast where things have come up to your point about having a seat at the table, where it really does seem like the problem has been that physicians did not have enough of a seat at the table. So to give two quick examples, Daniel Offrey wrote this New York Times editorial about 3 years ago called "The Business of Healthcare is Built on the Exploitation of Healthcare Workers," that basically makes the point that because healthcare workers are, you know, most of the time altruistic, but the people who run the companies that employ healthcare workers are seeking maximum efficiency, what happens is that the healthcare workers get squeezed and squeezed and squeezed and squeezed and squeezed, and then they quit, right? Or whatever. By the same token, we've had a lot of discussions about how with the electronic medical record, it seems that really, if you get right down to it, the prime directive of the electronic medical record is to maximize recuperation of money, you know, by maximizing billing and all that kind of thing. And that has taken precedence over physician well-being, patient well-being, maximizing either of those, the rest of it. And so it seems as though if you could have physicians really having a seat at the table in terms of how do healthcare companies put together their cost structures, or how does ChatGPT, when that gets implemented into healthcare, what is that implementation going to look like so that patients and physicians can remain at the center of those things rather than being these sort of peripheral afterthoughts, that would be really important. But how does the AMA go about trying to do that? You know, because you have no direct control, right, over how some company designs ChatGPT that may, yep, like Epic, end up taking over the way that it's implemented in healthcare. How do you look to get a seat at those kinds of tables?
Well, we are very intentional about making sure that the physician voice is present in the design, development, and implementation of health technologies, because we lived through the painful deployment and federal incentivization of electronic health records that was the number one dissatisfier of physicians for 10 years running. It's now two prior auth is number one. The way that the AMA is doing that very practically is we decided, you know, roughly 9 years ago to create an innovation company in Silicon Valley, right on Sand Hill Road across from Stanford, called Health 2047. And it is not a startup. Its job is to take problems that we see as the AMA, to bring physician entrepreneurs who have ideas and solutions for those problems, and then to launch companies. And Health 24/7 has launched at least a dozen companies at this point, and their goal is to make things better, but with a physician perspective driving the innovation, the tech, the products and services, and their whole variety of companies. You know, people can look it up if they're interested on health2047.com's website. That's one vehicle, part of our innovation ecosystem that we have tried to create. The other example is something called our Physician Innovation Network. It is a free online platform. It's got like, 18,000 people on it now. It's a place where companies who are developing products can look for physician input, and physicians who want to get involved with a company can post their interest. And we've seen some really wonderful examples of where a company, a physician have come together and gotten into the marketplace faster with a more effective product because of those interactions online that are facilitated by the Physician Innovation Network. It's open to anybody. It's free. You know, there's no monetization. We just want the physician voice to be articulated in more explicit ways so that we have technology that is an asset, not a burden, and works better for patients and physicians.
I'm just going to say that's a way better answer than I thought I was going to get. I'm impressed.
All right. Well, with the last few minutes we have here, we typically end our conversations with some advice that our guests might be able to share with our listeners who are largely medical trainees and people coming up the pipeline. But, you know, we've spent some time here discussing the uncertain future of medicine, as well as all the things that you and the AMA is trying to move it towards a better direction. That being said, it's still uncertain. And I think people have lots of, as the statistic Tyler mentioned, lots of people are, even people who have already committed to medical school, are on the path of not doing clinical practice. So I guess if you were to address future doctors, even pre-medical students, college students, who are considering or questioning whether or not medicine is right for them, amidst this uncertain future, what would you tell them about why this is still a worthwhile calling?
Well, look, there is nothing more satisfying than when I get to watch one of my patients leave the hospital without a brain tumor. And I'm an anesthesiologist. I do mostly neuroanesthesia cases. And I get to see that. I get to participate in that. I get to be an essential component of that happening. And I love the policy work. I love research and teaching and all of those things that I get to do. But at the end of the day, there is nothing more meaningful than knowing the impact that you can have on another human's life through the practice of medicine. And so I'm optimistic. We have so much talent available in the profession today. We've got a lot of bright people in our medical schools, a lot of bright people applying to go into medical schools. And I think we just need to make it easier for people to match their passion, their drive to support humanity, and what it means to be a physician in America today. And I know we'll get there. I'm optimistic we can get there. And certainly, I expect the AMA is going to be an important component of the solution.
Let me ask one follow-up question to that. You know, there's this moving section of your inaugural speech where you talk about, you contrast your experience the first time you came to an AMA meeting, which I think was as a medical student, or I might have the details wrong, but something along those lines. And this, as a point of reference, is, and again, I'm going to get the years wrong, but anyway, something like 2000, 2005, something, which is just to say that it is probably difficult for many current medical students to imagine this, but that was like a world away in terms of the place and acceptance and whatever of gay people in the United States and in the medical community and everything else. So you show up at this AMA meeting and you describe, and you know, of course you were also young and whatever else, but you describe kind of being on the back row, feeling like an outsider and sort of thinking, how is this ever really? And I think at that time you had maybe told a few friends or something, but in any case, you know, how is this really going to work? Like for me as a gay man just coming into this, like I, you know, what kind of future do I really have here? And then contrasted that in your inaugural speech with, well, the fact that you were giving the inaugural speech. So I guess that's just to say, to someone who, for whatever reason, for whatever part of their identity or background, is listening to this podcast and is thinking to themselves, gosh, like I feel the calling. I feel that like stirring in my soul that I want to be a doctor, like your, you know, story about helping to remove the brain tumor, whatever, that really speaks to me. And I would love to do that, but I don't have a place in medicine because I am fill in the blank with whatever thing, who feels like an outsider and isn't even sure that they could make it or that they would really have a place there. What would you say to that person?
Well, I hope that they are listening here and they have some hope, and that the visibility that I have brought as the first out gay man to be an AMA trustee, now AMA president, can help them realize that organizations can and will change, but only if people have the courage to step up. And that might be in your school, that might be in your medical staff, that might be in your hospital, that might be in your professional society. But certainly, you know, it's striking for me, not just to think back to 2001 when I first went to my first AMA meeting as a first-year medical student, and how different the AMA is, how more inclusive the AMA is, how much the AMA has pivoted in terms of its advocacy for marginalized and underrepresented communities, including LGBTQ individuals. But I don't know, 50 years ago, pick the number, I couldn't have even been an AMA member as an out gay man, right? Because of the stigma and the fact that homosexuality was a disease, right? In the DSM at that point, that, you know, when I was chair of the AMA board in 2019, we had our first Black female president, Patrice Harris, an incredible leader. She couldn't have been an AMA member because the AMA didn't allow Black physicians at its founding to be a part of the association. So, you know, organizations can evolve, they do evolve, but only if people have the courage to step up.
Well, with that, we want to thank you very much for sharing your story, for your powerful message, and for sharing your optimism with all of us. We need it in today's time and age. So thank you again for taking the time to join us. It was a true pleasure.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you for joining our conversation on this week's episode of The Doctor's Art. You can find program notes and transcripts of all episodes at thedoctorsart.com. If you enjoyed the episode, please subscribe, rate, and review our show, available for free on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We also encourage you to share the podcast with any friends or colleagues who you think might enjoy the program. And if you know of a doctor, patient, or anyone working in healthcare who would love to explore meaning and medicine with us on the show, feel free to leave a suggestion in the comments.
I'm Henry Baer.
And I'm Tyler Johnson. We hope you can join us next time. Until then, be well.